Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free and independent, meandering, conversational, lighthearted, yet exasperated, researched, yet off-the-cuff, educated, yet speculative, weekly podcast where we tell you what to think about politics, global affairs, current events, music, social media, culture, and anything else that bubbles up from the unlocked and unhinged comment threads in our brains. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Loaded Nemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at GreenWeird, which is green underscore WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Week Thoughts, a confusing attempt to wrap our heads around the super PAC supporting Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Wisconsin, Kevin Nicholson, a reaction to the Trump administration's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, a background on Eric Prince and the Amintor Group's attempt at building a private spy agency for CIA Director Mike Pompeo, and updates on Zimbabwe, Myanmar, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and more. Prepare yourself to get riled up and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think.
Charles, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Pete?
Pretty good. Have you been watching Punisher?
I've watched all of it in about 2 days.
Okay, nice. You're way ahead of me. What you like it?
Yeah, I really liked it. I think it was one of the best Marvel Netflix shows that they put out.
Yeah.
Maybe Jessica Jones edging it out. Maybe.
Yeah, I like how, as much as I liked Daredevil, it didn't have an overriding social issue like Luke Cage does with race, Jessica Jones does with,
alcoholism.
Well, I was going to say, like, femininity and, I mean, really, Jessica Jones was kind of, like, man, if that came out within the past couple weeks, that would be, like, the biggest internet show ever, dealing with, like, sexual assault
control issues, to say
the
least.
Yeah, exactly.
Patriarchy.
Yep, exactly. And then Punisher obviously has this war and veteran issue. And I just find it totally compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Really a big Punisher fan traditionally, but I think they're doing a great job.
Right. I find his morality, shall we say, infantile? Well, not infantile, but overly simplistic, but it's a really compelling show. I mean, I understand why he does it, but to my mind, it seems like you're giving up by just immediately going to a final solution to any problem.
I totally agree. Which is, from what I understand about Punisher, true to the character.
Yeah.
But I like, though, that they're setting that guy into this really complex situation. You know, global affairs, terrorism, torture, all these issues we've been dealing with since at least 9/11, if not longer. And like any good superhero show, let's throw a comic book character into the middle of it and see what happens.
Well, I mean, it's almost satire in some ways. I mean, put a mask over Frank Castle, like, you know, that one scene that's repeatedly played in the show, and it's like that could be almost any special forces operator that we've trained that has to deal with those issues anymore.
Yeah, and you're saying how he has an infantile morality, which, I mean, I guess a lot of comic book characters do, but usually that isn't as pronounced. So take something like even just another Netflix Marvel show like Luke Cage. Like, Luke Cage has a pretty simplistic morality, but I don't think he's wrong. I would describe him as, you know, standing up for strong beliefs.
Right.
Infantile, but they're both kind of simplistic.
Well, I guess the problem that I have with the difference between Luke Cage and the Punisher, for instance, is that Luke Cage's morality is aspirational. At no time does he assume that he is absolutely right in what he's doing.
Good point, yeah.
He's trying to learn how to be a superhero. And the Punisher is just like, oh, well, I've got guns, those are the bad guys. Simple as fuck.
See, so I just finished with think it's the fourth episode, and they got a little bit more into his, it's the one where he doesn't want to go on this mission. He thinks it's a trap. It turns out to be a trap, and he, goes through a slaughter fest through this compound or whatever. And, you know, that's it. It's almost like he and, the other guy, what's his name? Bill or whatever.
His companion, Billy. Yeah,
the other lieutenant. They are sort of in a complex situation. They are sort of playing a game. They know that. They're just following the rules or, orders. But that doesn't really, in the end, help Frank Castle. It doesn't lead him anywhere good. And I think he just kind of takes this, it just sort of like inverting. I mean, he's a soldier. In the end, he's a soldier.
Well, a Marine, but yeah.
Yeah, but he's just sort of flipping it. I'm going to just follow all orders, maybe speak my mind, but follow orders, to now I'm not following anyone, but it's still kind of just as simple. He's never going to be like a leader of men. He's not one for compromise, never has been, never will be.
I mean, I could see why that would be appealing to people, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even the law. Like, he's... To him, the ultimate authority is just his own sense of right and wrong. And how many people are hurt by what other people do.
And even before that, though, it was just vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
But going after his family's killers.
Well, I mean, it's the same morality, but applied to himself.
Yeah. No, but it's super compelling. Like, I think the Netflix shows, especially not, I'm not talking about Iron Fist at all, by the way. I didn't watch it. I have no interest in it. He's a fine character, but I have no interest in watching it.
Oh, that was another great show.
What, Iron Fest? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. I mean, the RZA directs like two or three of the episodes.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. I liked his character in The Defenders. I just watched the first episode and I couldn't even get through it. I didn't like it.
Yeah, the first episode was difficult, but okay. It gets going after that with like most of the Netflix shows.
I'll go back to it. But anyway, most of these, they're made, unlike the movies, the Netflix shows seem to be made for adults. And you don't have to unequivocally follow the protagonist. He's not always right, or she. He's not.
And none of them are completely right.
No, yeah, it's...
Except maybe Jessica Jones.
Yeah, even she, though, gets drunk and causes trouble.
Yeah, but that's more like inadvertent consequences than, the consequences of what she was trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're all really well done, and they're complex. They remind me back in the 90s, I think they're even using a number of the same characters. Back in the 90s, Marvel made the Marvel Knights, imprint, K-N-I-G-H-T-S. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think they did actually put Daredevil into it. I know Punisher was in it.
Oh, and Moon Knight was.
Yeah, and they had, they were supposed to be a little bit more adult. I think whatever rating system they use for comics, they had.
Oh, and Ghost Rider was the fourth one.
Oh, he definitely was in it, yeah. And not that they were
overly adult, but it was just more, grittier content.
Yeah, exactly. So, to the news. It's been a big news week.
Yeah,
big huge stuff with Flynn indictment and guilty plea.
The tax plan that is rolling through the Senate like a juggernaut.
The tax plan was not to be stopped. We'll see how it goes through reconciliation. That passed late in the night, a few days ago, Saturday.
Saturday morning. Saturday, I got to say, morning. It's like the first time that I've stayed up until like 2 in the morning waiting for the results of a bill.
Yeah, it was. I figured it would pass, but it was interesting seeing because I stayed up probably till midnight watching a lot of the feed, and it's interesting seeing the Democrats go after every little. Oh, no, I shouldn't say little, but but a lot of the provisions that they found appalling. And I think as much as it was trying to stonewall things, it was trying to just bring it on the record that this is a thing. You know, that, that this is, you know, they talked about the drilling in Alaska. They talked about children's health care. They talked about the mandate. They talked about that, like, the Sanders thing was all about this.
The automatic cuts to Social Security and Medicare based on, you know, the tax cuts.
I think I heard over the weekend that Susan Collins gave her vote on this because she's against repealing the mandate. But she was under the impression there'd be this other bill that would be passed by the Senate. Don't have my facts in front of me.
Is that the Alexander Graham bill?
Yes, that's it. And I guess the Senate now has dropped that. So there is still a question of whether they'll get the votes through the Senate the next time. I mean, it's not passed into law yet.
Right. It's not. It's just, it still has to go through reconciliation, too. So they have to find, for instance, the estate tax, which is another deplorable part of it. In the House version, the estate tax goes away entirely in 2023, but it does not in the Senate bill. Yeah.
Interesting.
There's just a lot of disingenuous three-card Monty about this whole bill. But the most disingenuous gaslighting is all of these Republicans going, well, I'm sorry, I won't say Republicans, but all of these pundits and politicians going in front of the cameras saying that this bill will be paid for by economic growth, which is like the magic asterisk in Paul Ryan's tax plan. There's always so much weight being carried by that little symbol, because all of his hopes and dreams are just carried in it, and it will, I guess, rise up into the sky and rain down money in the form of Ben Bernanke or somehow.
I'm not sure. He can always justify any of the math, or he can counter any of the math with this nebulous concept of, well, if we only get 0.3% growth, we'll have $5 trillion more. I mean, it's always a changing number. It's always just convenient enough to make it work.
Yeah, it's not in service to economic growth that they would do these things. I just go back to that Gary Cohn video at the Wall Street Journal, little CEO's hobnob, where the assistant editor was like, how many of you are going to increase your capital investment? And then Gary Cohn is just left chuckling nervously on the stage, like, why aren't more hands going up? Son of a bitch.
We've also had a couple troublesome elections in the world in the past week or so. There's one in Honduras. Can you tell me what's going on down there?
So they had an election about a week ago, and as they were counting the votes, all of a sudden the left-wing parties formed a coalition and put up a talk show host who is, you know, widely known as their candidate. And when they started tallying the votes and she started winning, all of a sudden the Electoral Commission stopped publishing, you know, the counts that they had and started just putting it out in statements like, oh, the president is, looks like he's gonna win this one after all. And so, as you might imagine, people are hesitant to believe that. There was a military curfew imposed, and the people, for the most part, are ignoring that and seem to be continuing their push for representative democracy and to make sure that their votes matter. But The Intercept actually had a pretty good article detailing how the military organizations that we've trained, that Zelaya, is Manuel Zelaya, I got the names in front of me, has been training himself, like Tigray and Cobra, are in the forefront of repressing these demonstrations. These are special forces organizations that are with the hundreds of millions of dollars that we give to Honduras, in some way they're funded and trained by our money.
I believe this past week the State Department just greenlit more money.
Right, and because they said that this election was free and fair, like,
yes.
Even before it's already resolved, the State Department released a memo that Reuters saw, and it's like, oh, this is above board. Two thumbs up, carry on.
Yeah, which seems like a very blatant support of the current president without even knowing
right.
The details of the election.
Well, one tin pot dictator's got to support another. And with the drastic personnel cuts at the State Department, who's to say is even typing up these memos?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's what the kids are doing in school nowadays, being outsourced to write State Department memos.
No, they'd go to a Russian troll farm. But the Russian troll farm would be more competent in, like, cut and paste, like, actual previous memos so it would look professional.
And in Kenya, they also had an election, and the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Uhuru Kenyatta.
Is starting a little crackdown of his political opponents. A David Ndiaye,
mm-hmm.
who was a senior advisor to the opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, was detained. Some of the people there think it's going to be the start of a bigger crackdown. Now, what is the dispute over? Was there questions in their election, or?
Well, Kenyatta's another tin pot dictator. This isn't the last, like the last time they had election, his force, or his supporters, basically a irregular militia, killed hundreds of people. So he's just cementing his power again.
I had an impression of Kenya as one of the more stable countries in East Africa. Are they
maybe.
Stable because they have a dictator? Or
yeah, okay. They are. I mean, they were more democratic before Kenyatta came to power. Like,
okay. Most,
but now it's just devolved into a one-party state, basically. I mean, maybe it's kind of a warning for democracy that tin pot dictators seem to be able to rise up to the top and just stay there.
No. We shouldn't learn any lessons. No.
Right. No lessons. Right. Tunnel vision.
Nothing to do with us.
Look straight ahead.
Nothing to see over there.
Right.
Mega. Oh, the Supreme Court temporarily upheld the travel ban that has not been getting a ton of play as far as I'm concerned, just I think because there's so much fucking else going on. But
it's huge.
But yeah, that's the thing that got me though is that they're even still pursuing it. Because the whole idea was that it was like 180 days or something?
Mm-hmm.
And we need this to be safe over these
right.
presumably next 180 days. Well, more than 180 days have gone by, and we haven't had a foreign terrorist attack. So,
what was the point of that, then?
Yeah, I mean, where's?
I mean, but you know, it's the same ploy. You can't prove a negative, so they're going to point at that negative and be like, "See, we were right. That we had a chilling effect on people trying to get into the country because they heard about our enhanced security measures."
Oh, I like that spin on it. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Just the threat of it
mm-hmm.
kept the terrorists away.
Donald Trump is making the world safe for everybody except for the people underneath our bombs.
So, the
travel ban itself is currently within, like, two circuit court of appeals are kicking back, like, the judge in Hawaii issued a stay, but Washington, D.C., they refused to mandate a stay, and the Supreme Court itself was, like, included in their previous decision, included language about, what was the exact phrasing, but it basically meant that you had to have a connection to America, like, by an institution, like, you know, you're coming here for work at university or from a family member. And they were applying it to, like, all the way down to, like, grandparents and grandchildren, all the way out to, like, nieces and nephews, cousins. Okay. But, yeah, now the Supreme Court in its language of this, their latest ruling was interesting. The fact that they're allowing it to go into effect means that they basically anticipate that it will go into effect, ultimately. Hmm. But they also told the lower courts to be more expeditious about their arguments, try to move it through.
Which is probably fair, actually. I mean, on some level, if the federal government thinks something needs to be done quickly, I do think that courts should probably decide quickly. It doesn't mean they have to agree, of course.
Well, yeah, but there should be some accommodation of public opinion and objective fact, I guess. Like, if all of a sudden a bunch of people show up at the airport to be like, hey, this is not what America's about. Please let these poor refugees into our country. And, you know, they put on North Korea and Venezuela as a fig leaf, you know, travel ban 3.0, now with North Korea and Venezuela. See, it's not racist.
Yeah.
It's
going to turn out like Children of Men, where just every country is banned from coming to America.
But the worst part about this is that they're targeting these countries, for instance, Venezuela. So this means that no one from Venezuela can come into America, which means the people who are they want to notionally help, the people who are being subject to the depredations of the Caracas regime, are unable to flee to America. So you're basically putting up a wall that the refugees can, I guess, put up their tents and die beneath.
Well, I mean, at least Trump's consistent. He's been pretty... He doesn't really give a shit about refugees.
Yeah, I guess he has been consistent in his callous disregard for people in general.
Which is
then really, there was a.
It just really does not follow in the history of. I mean, think about like Cuba would be a huge example of people politically leaving, coming to America who didn't like a new regime in their home country.
Right, can you imagine what would happen if anybody after, like, Eisenhower or Kennedy was like, no, we don't like anybody in Cuba, so all of you boat people will have nowhere to go.
And I think that's where it becomes, whether it's you're like a racist or a theist.
Classist?
Thesis? No.
Theological? yeah.
But where it becomes an issue of a broader... hatred or phobia, bias,
xenophobia.
Because it's not about being a radical Islamic terrorist. It's not about being a communist. If you're not allowing even the people who don't like those things to come to your country, and you're just a blanket. I mean, I understand their logic is that, well, they're gonna lie and say they're not
abandoned. What about the people who aren't lying?
They don't get any they don't get a due process, they don't get a
right. What about
the doubt?
What about that small business owner who just saw his entire store looted because of, you know, the lines for food and basic goods, and then had everything stolen and is trying to find safety?
Yep. He should dye his hair blonde and change his name to John Smith or something. I don't know what else.
Yes. Oh, I know. He can pay a bribe and get Colombian identity papers.
Yeah, no, you are there is a, the more they crack down on the borders, to me there's just going to be more illegal.
Yeah, it's just driving up the price of coyotes.
Yeah. It's like, you know, like the drug war or something, you know.
Right. I mean, if there wasn't such a huge shall we say demand issue.
Well, which he's working on that.
Wait, is he trying to put more people on drugs by cutting the social safety network? And
I just mean he's making the Trump administration is making America a less desirable place to come to.
Right. Oh, which also coincides with the announcement at the UN that we're pulling out of the UN Convention on Refugees because it's incompatible with our they with our strategy or our territorial ambitions, or no, that's what Hitler would have said. No, it was something
yeah, it was something like our values, and then they said, and the Trump administration's policy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, supposedly.
Yeah, what would I imagine Eleanor Roosevelt's corpse is probably just crawling its root, trying to scrape through the dirt above it to get back up.
I understand that Nikki Haley was the only one who wanted us to stay in to negotiate. I mean, I don't think she's terribly not aligned with the administration, but she at least seems to want to still stay in diplomatic negotiations.
Wow, what does being a diplomat done to her? She goes from being a hardline ideological governor of South Carolina who hated the UN, and now that she's in the UN, she's like, wait, let's give diplomacy a shot. It has value.
Well, that's an interesting conversation. Is it that that's her job, and so to keep her job relevant and any, you know, semblance of power, they have to stay in these things.
But they hate the globalists, which is an interesting contradiction.
Or is she, yeah, but self, you know, put self before all else when you're
yeah,
ambitious, you know, politician.
I mean, this is her way of getting foreign policy chops so that she can look at the presidency, maybe even the Republican primary in 2020.
I don't think, you think someone from the administration is going to go against Trump? Unless he doesn't run, which I still think is a possibility.
I mean, if he makes it to run.
Well, yeah. Of
course. I mean, okay, so assuming that
one's going to run against Pence. Well, but now we're assuming Pence is. Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions to make.
There's a lot of things up in the air, shall we say, about the next few years.
Yeah, that's what makes it fun.
Is that the word for it? Fun?
Yeah. Well... All right, I think we should get into a deeper discussion of something. We'll be right back after we
Kevin Nicholson, a strong fiscal conservative who backed that one from life. In my younger days, I was a Democrat. I used to do nothing and know everything. But since then, we've had three kids. I've bought in two wars, and I've worked in businesses around the world. And after you've been hit in the face with that much reality, you cannot help but become a strong conservative. The one thing in life you cannot compromise is your principles. I'm strongly believing. I've seen innocent children killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And here in this country, it is unacceptable for our government to systematically allow the lives of innocent children.
Pro-Second Amendment. Strong, firm up. Waste your life in a struggle with power. All men thus reduced to please,
so fucking just do whatever you please. A few days ago, I heard a radio commercial. It was for Kevin Nicholson, who in Wisconsin, where we are, is running for the Republican nomination for Senator Tammy Baldwin, the Democrat, for her seat in the Senate. And there's a couple challenges right now going up for it. And the commercial I heard was touting his background as a Bronze Star awarded Marine, multiple tours in Iraq. Sounded like a hell of a soldier, this Kevin Nicholson.
Marine.
Sorry. And he currently works for a political consulting group, GH Smart, but they don't bring that up in the commercial. What they bring up are national security things. And what they say in the ad is that he can help keep America safe from North Korea, Russia, and Iran. And I just about crashed my car because these duplicitous Republicans who are telling us Russia is anywhere from not a threat to good right now. One of these PACs is now putting out commercials supporting a Republican candidate because he can help keep us protected from Russia. And this pack is called America's Pack. And that put me down a wormhole of seedy conservative bullshit that I would like to talk about, Charles.
Please. This Nicholson guy sounds like an interesting character.
Well, he won't tell us what he's been doing at this consulting firm.
I mean, consulting firms make a lot of money. Like, he could be consulting for Uline Incorporated, the company that's given Solutions for America $3.5 million and appears to be their only source of money.
Yep. So, let's get into that. This America's Pack. It's funded by...
Or Solutions for America, I think it's called.
Let's get into this, because the way I understand it is America's Pack is getting money for this ad from Solutions for
Wisconsin, sorry.
For Wisconsin. These are two separate packs which are kind of funding each other. And so this specific ad that I heard...
Oh, is that the $200,000 ad buy that that showed up? Okay, that's...
Yes. And so the Uline, he gives money to America's Pack, I believe.
Find a Solutions for Wisconsin.
Oh, Solutions for Wisconsin, which I believe is based out of, like, Kansas or something. Texas. Here it is. Based out of Austin, Texas is their PO.
That is, like, one employee.
Yep. And these shady packs have gotten into a lot of interesting... they put out a lot of interesting ads over the years. And that's what really got me on this. What are some things that you noticed about them?
As I said, they have one apparent donor, this Uline guy who owns Uline Incorporated. And he's given them, $3.5 million for just the 2018 cycle. So yeah. He's going to put all of that money behind Nicholson, or I guess whoever the Republican candidate ends up being running against Tammy Baldwin, but it's kind of they're putting their finger on the scale early in the crowded field to make sure that, you know, this guy's wishes are known. And he's typing on North Korea, Iran, and those, shall we say, security issues, because I guess those insecurities make people feel better when they're addressed.
Yeah, and people in Wisconsin who are afraid of those things probably are not huge Tammy supporters, I guess.
Yeah, I would bet.
Even though she's now in the Senate as part of the party that is pressing the president on Russian connections.
But she's not in the Intelligence or Judiciary Committee,
no.
Is there?
No. I don't believe that. So this Uline, Richard Uline, is his family, or he owns Uline
Incorporated,
which is a
retail company.
Okay,
it's in the retail industry, but
okay, I see their trucks around is why.
Yeah,
he has given a lot of money in the past. There were some big numbers thrown around as I was looking into.
Right, he gave like $26 million during the 2016 cycle.
This America's Pack has put a lot of, they've worked in Wisconsin before. They've backed Walker for a couple elections, putting out a number of ads. The thing that I found interesting about America's Pack is that they claim to be a pack that's trying to reach minority voters. And they claim to, well, they claim to be really successful in that. They've put out some ads in the past with, tell us about that one.
This ad is atrocious. That's at the bottom of this Mother Jones article. Like, to read the quote or the exchange from the ad, if you make a little mistake with one of your hoes, you'll want to dispose of that problem too sweet. The French phrase with all possible speed. No questions asked. No, that's too cold. I don't snuff my own seed. Huh? Really? Well, maybe you do have a reason to vote Republican.
Yes. So, okay, everyone.
I would like to point out.
Everyone go take a shower. Just pause the podcast. Go take a shower.
And look up the phrase too sweet. T-O-U-T-S-U-I-T-E. A obscure French phrase that, I mean, maybe not, maybe it's hot on the street, but they do like using strange little devices and wraps.
So, you know, this is, like, I'm really trying to get facts straight on this, but it's really hard with these packs. Because then I see something else here that has America's pack listed as an Iowa-based pack.
Do they move?
Yeah, maybe it's... Yeah, so is there? Is it are old?
Right. Is it a different 501c corporation or company that, or I guess organization with a similar name?
No, so, they're both America's Pack. That
well, America's large enough for more than one pack.
Yeah. Wait, no, you're right. It's Solutions. We're getting a little off the rails here. Solutions for Wisconsin is based in Austin, Texas. America's Pack is based in Iowa. Now, the thing I found interesting was that the packs give money to other packs to put out ads. Why would they do that?
Well, I guess if they're going to consolidate production costs, like they all want to put out this ad, and so they'll share the cost of it.
Yeah,
I mean, it'd be better than having them, like, say, for instance, they're going to put $1 million into a television advertisement, and it has this message that they all want. It'd be easier for them to contribute, you know, 200,000 amongst five organizations to make that ad rather than each one of those organizations paying, like, in competing against each other for advertising space. Because, you know, if all of a sudden there are five different organizations that are willing to put up $1 million for 30-second ads in that time slot, the value of that ad would go up incredibly. The TV station would justifiably be like, well, that ad is now 1.5 million.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of a way of circumventing competition in the marketplace, too, over the finite resource of time on television.
Not to harp too much on how confused I am, but I think this is really speaking to something, because it's just... I've heard this notion brought up that... I believe this was actually brought up in the Citizens United case, I believe, by Kennedy, which is, well, just look at who's funding these things, and if you don't like it, then don't support it. But I'm trying to find out who's doing this, and I can't even figure out where this office is, because now I'm looking up America's PAC, is the only officer in it is from Kansas. Ah! So
it's a legal entity in Iowa that's run by some guy on his computer in Kansas, probably in an office park somewhere. And he's sending money to a different guy in Austin so that they
can... Or at least a P.O. box in Austin.
Right, so that they can run issue ads for a candidate in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin,
and it's all being funded by a guy in Northern Illinois.
This is making... Yeah, okay, that's... It's a little confusing when you put it all out in a line like that.
And then, you know, and how many of these packs are there now? You know, I mean, no reasonable person, no reasonable voter can follow this stuff. And all I'm trying to figure out is why this guy running for Senate in Wisconsin is putting out ads that say we need to be protected from Russia. And back to this, who he's consulted for. As far as I understand, it's pretty rare for a senatorial candidate not to be open about that.
Mm. I mean, normally they're not in this kind of position where they have to worry about transparency. They're often public officials or already elected officials.
Yeah.
Or they're, you know, besides the FOIA and public release laws, they've got journalists that are notionally investigating them almost constantly. But yeah, this guy works for a management consulting company and lives in Delafield. Mm-hmm. He's going to have to release his client list, I would expect.
Well, he's been pretty adamant that he's not going to.
Well, then, I mean, this is, well, the president won't release his tax returns, putting two middle fingers at a giant fucking, shall we say, historical tradition among presidents, so the fact that some lower candidates in lower offices are doing the same, it shouldn't be surprising to anybody.
As soon as we set that precedent, why would anyone else follow it?
Right.
So I'm seeing here, this is further why I'm getting a little confounded about this Russia stuff. And I'm probably just really harping on one thing that some intern included in the ad. But so Breitbart's like touting this Kevin Nicholson guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard WisPolitics, like even in their headline, they're like, solutions for Wisconsin PAC. Bannon-affiliated super PAC backs conservative outsider Kevin Nicholson. And they're like, they are the most wishy-washy. Like, they will not take any stand. They will pointedly not take a stand. So for them to say it's a Bannon-affiliated super PAC is saying something.
And there's other PACs here. There's a John Bolton PAC.
Oh my god, that guy.
Well, knowing PACs, he's probably not even associated with it. Maybe I'm making an assumption here. But they've already endorsed Nicholson as of 2 months ago.
I'm not sure which is scarier, the fact that John Bolton has a pack, or that maybe there's a group of people who are so enamored and loyal to John Bolton that they created a pack in his name.
There needs to be, I don't know what there needs to be. It's just so frustrating. To try and figure out.
I mean, I think we should just go back to publicly financed elections to get rid of all of this nonsense.
Yeah, it would at least simplify it, because if money is going to be such an important part of political campaigns, then the reasonable voter should be able to be aware of these things while putting forth a reasonable amount of effort. But I don't know that that's
right.
Really possible. Because at best, we're relying
right.
on
How
newspapers
much...
to investigate these people and figure out and follow the money. And that takes time and resources, and they can only do so many candidates, so many PACs. And you're relying then on newspapers to not have a bias, which for the most part, I trust journalism, but come on, a lot of them do.
They kind of choose who they dig into, but...
Yeah, I mean, they're only human, too. I mean, they...
Right, everybody makes mistakes.
They have to prioritize. It looks like there's going to be a strong Republican primary. I'm just preparing for a lot of crazy, honestly.
Yeah, it's kind of a crowded field of crazy. We've got Dale Kuyenga, who's like a total ideologue. Fucking, he's the guy who keeps putting in those crazy, crazy, super conservative things in the assembly. They're putting them forward. They usually don't even pass. And so fringe.
So
then Leah Vukmir, who's more middle of the road, but still an arch conservative, and then the arch conservative, you might as well be like search for Republican in Wisconsin in Google, and I bet Scott Fitzgerald's picture is one of the first ones that comes up. He's also in the running.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh. I always expected him to.
Right.
I actually hadn't heard yet that he was.
I'm not sure if I would prefer him or a Donald Trump wannabe.
I would guess that the Bannon, I hate giving him so much credit that he's running all of the crazy conservatives in the country. He's just one of many. But it's easy to...
Well, he's also in charge of their primary media source, so it's easy to attribute, like, oh, they all agree with him, so it must be... fact that he put out that idea that they're agreeing with it. It's like, no, those people probably reached that idea independently.
So this Bannon Trump wing, whatever you want to call it, this Breitbart crowd, I would imagine they are going to be throwing money at a few of these people.
Oh, yeah, probably Kevin Nicholson if I had to bet.
Well, they already are, apparently with him, but I'm guessing these other ones too. They'll throw many at them now, and whichever one wins, unless, John C. Globalist emerges from the crowd, I'm pretty sure they're going to just back any of them against Tammy. I imagine they loathe Tammy.
Oh, it's going to be one of the biggest races in the 2018 cycle. They are going to pour money, just pallet fulls of cash. out of backs of planes to get her out of office.
Yeah, I wonder how much money political consulting firms and PR firms and all that make in Wisconsin these past 10 years and how much that's gone up. Unless these are being run from out of state, too. I don't know how that works.
Well, there's been a lot of lobbying firms that have popped up in Madison. Like, there was that Koch base where Koch Brothers won.
Yeah.
I remember that. So, yeah, I imagine the lobbying firms haven't closed. They probably proliferated.
Yeah, it just seems like with Wisconsin being this test ground state, that must have become pretty lucrative.
Right? I mean, since we're Alex Policy Laboratory, everybody wants to contribute, and the way you do that is through lobbyists, people who are willing to stand there at the door and go to those terrible, terrible cocktail parties.
To achieve that, the team has in it an entrepreneur, you, a real estate lawyer, a bankruptcy lawyer. I don't know how you've lasted 8 months in this lineup, but that's for another day. And it's impressive that it's still going. There's not a Middle East mafia in this group. So, I mean, how do you operate with people who basically, you know, you don't do respect, you want to go to Dr. Jules, you have no idea about it.
So,
what are you guys doing?
So, seriously,
I don't understand this.
So, I'll definitely say it's not a conventional team, but...
you can say that again.
That's what I said.
Go say it again.
Okay. It's a perfectly qualified team in the way Heim sees it. So,
how is that?
All right, Charles, as we're recording our meandering podcast here, we're getting a little bit of breaking news. It looks like the Trump administration, despite opposition from all sides, well, maybe not all political sides, but from around the world, has declared that they will be moving in 6 months their embassy, our embassy, America's embassy, to Jerusalem. And we will be recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me what you think. Why do I care?
This is going to unleash protests and violence against American interests everywhere between Morocco and Pakistan. The Palestinian-Israeli issue is one of the few unifying things that, for instance, the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Countries, feels is one of, you know, the one, even beyond the Sunni-Shiite divide, that's something that they can all agree on. And so this is, well, I misspoke. I meant all the way from Morocco to Indonesia. I didn't need to leave off all of those.
Yeah.
Most of the Muslims in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, Indonesia is a big...
The most popular, most Muslims in the world.
Yep. So, why would they care?
Because this means that, well, Palestine wants part of Jerusalem for their capital, and the fact that that was going to be part of the negotiations, and so if we're already moving to, shall we say, the latter stages of the negotiations, then you can imagine what other compromises that they'll be willing to make with the Palestinian people, because they wanted Jerusalem to be their capital too for a cohesive Palestinian sovereign state.
And why can't they both have their capital there?
Because Jerusalem is only so big.
So the way I understand Israel's motivation under Netanyahu lately, and possibly the Trump administration's, is looking more like that, is that they want a one-state solution. Can you tell me about the difference between the one-state and the two-state solution beyond kind of the obvious of one state and two states? I mean, what would either entail?
Okay, well, it's kind of an interesting matrix of choices. For instance, with a two-state solution, that could be basically what exists now, where you have the Gaza Strip and then areas A, B, and C in the West Bank that are either that are a continuum of Palestinian and Israeli military control than Israel proper. So notionally, in a two-state solution, the Gaza Strip and whatever part of the West Bank, it should be up to the 1967 borders, but that's only been the starting point for negotiations. There's always been expected land swaps to so the Palestinians could have a viable, cohesive state.
Yeah.
With a two-state solution, the Gaza Strip and West Bank would become their own sovereign state, and Israel would remain their own state. And the Palestinians would get sovereignty over their finances, which they don't have, over their judicial system, over their foreign policy. And there's always been the expectation that the Palestinian state would be demilitarized. So, not entirely sovereign, I guess. The one-state solution is, I've heard one-state, two systems, whereby all of the land would be, I guess, Israel, and there would be two systems of laws. Well, I guess this is only the one basic choice for a one, for one-state solution, is that there would be two sets of laws for these, for Israeli Jewish citizens and Palestinians. Well, Israeli citizens, because obviously there's Christian and Druze and other ethnicities in Israel besides these, just the Jewish contingent.
Sounds like that would almost be like federalized.
Yeah, it would be a federalized structure. Of course, then there's the other less desirable option for a one-state solution whereby there continues to be, shall we say, two systems of laws, but only one avenue to prosperity, shall we say. The only one that involves an avenue to prosperity and, you know, national health, for lack of a better term, because it will turn into apartheid. The Palestinians will have completely unequal representation before the law, which means either they'll be taxed or they won't earn as much as they should. Yeah, there's no good solution for that.
Along those lines, it seems to me that, and maybe I'm being a little cynical here, that there is a one-state solution that is even worse than that. Maybe not.
No, I mean, there is a worse option, but I don't think even Netanyahu would be willing to impose that kind of solution.
Okay. So what does this tell us about the Netanyahu administration's next step after this? Or
well, they've had a couple problems. They've had cabinet members leave recently. So this will help shore up their domestic support, but this also signals or tells me that the Trump administration thinks that they're just going to get whatever they want and are going to dictate the facts on the ground.
What? What? That doesn't sound like Trump.
Right. Another part of this is part of Kushner's Middle East peace plan that I've heard recently is that the Saudi Arabians had agreed to spend billions of dollars to create and finance a Palestinian state. So, you know, if this is part of that negotiations whereby the Palestinians might lose Jerusalem as their capital, but they get a state, I could see how that is a good starting, not necessarily a good starting point for negotiations, but at least a basis for discussion.
But
there seems to be their basis for discussion more appropriately.
But if that were the case, why would the president of the Palestinians be so against this?
Abbas?
Yeah.
I don't think he was included. Yeah, I don't think he's been included in any of these negotiations. A lot of this seems to be between Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Jared Kushner, who's, of course, senior special advisor to the Orange in Chief, and Netanyahu in his office.
I mean, here on CNN, I'm seeing, despite President Abbas's objection.
Yeah, there's no way he would agree to that. Because even if they are, you know, their support is purchased, that would probably mean that he wouldn't have a popular political, he wouldn't have a good political position. Because imagine having to take that check and then turn around and tell everybody, so we're going to get a lot less than we had anticipated. The millions of Palestinians who are living in the diaspora are never going to be able to come home. We're probably going to lose all control of our water in the West Bank. The Gaza Strip will continue to be, shall we say, heavily militarized at its border. So there might even be three states in that respect, because the Gaza Strip might be subject to its own kind of administrative rules and requirements.
It looks like you're, even Turkey's speaking out as well.
Yeah, Erdogan has never had a good relationship with Netanyahu. Remember, one of the most interesting and unsung moments of Obama's administration was he had Netanyahu and Erdogan meet at an airport. And I don't know what he said to them, but eventually, this is after seven Turkish citizens and one American citizens were killed on that freighter by Israeli forces when they were trying to run the embargo into Gaza. Erdogan, of course, was upset about that. And eventually, Obama did something to get them to at least talk again. But yeah, they've always had Turkey and Israel in the past decade or so have had a tense relationship. Because, you know, they've had the same leaders for the past decade.
Is there anything else you want to add about this at the moment?
It's interesting to see how Jared Kushner's Middle East peace plan is, the pieces of it are coming out, and we're getting an idea of what its outlines look like. If I were even the ranking member or chairman of either the Senate Foreign Relations Committee or its House analog, I would be incredibly concerned that such huge foreign policy commitments are being made behind closed doors with foreign officials, and there's no input from the American people, like not even a press conference. Have you ever seen Jared Kushner speak? I'm still not convinced he can.
Yeah, only on John Oliver where they use the voice of Gilbert Gottfried. That's the only time I've heard him speak.
I guess he did something this past weekend, but I haven't watched any of the video from it. But he gives like zero public appearances.
Well, and even without direct congressional input, it's not even going through the State Department.
Oh, right, and that's the other thing. Like, the State Department is also being entirely cut out. No wonder Tillerson is furious, or seems to be angry. And it's like he didn't send perhaps that was aimed at Kushner, where he didn't send a delegation to accompany Ivanka Trump to that conference in India last week.
You know, this will kind of almost lead us into our next topic, but this idea of the administration not just dismantling government to make it smaller, but then doing the things that we have departments set up to do, but doing them independently from them.
Right.
Is that just a way to centralize control to the president's hands? I mean, what?
Well, there's a twofold reasons that I can see. Is as you pointed out, it centralizes all the decision making in the Oval Office. Like, you can't have somebody at the State Department come up with a good idea and run it up the flag chain the food chain to the Secretary of State and have him just take it and run with it. Everything comes down from the Oval Office, and you know, the hive of advisors that he keeps around him.
But is it, well, what's your second reason?
Is that there's little to no oversight.
Yeah, that's
right. If this were at the State Department or the Department of Defense, there would be some kind of records, memos, like budgets, spending, you know, there would be records and points of information that historians and hopefully journalists would be able to use to convey the truth to other people.
Is this a judicial issue, or is this purely a legislative, the legislator standing up to the executive branch?
I mean, the legislature is supposed to represent the interests of the American people in our government, because obviously we don't have rapid means of petitioning our government. There's, of course, civil cases, but besides the rules of standing, there are other impediments to like seeking legal recourse. Like if you think something the president is doing is going to destroy our country.
Yeah.
So you call your congressman and they're supposed to pull in like, you know, the undersecretary of policy and like the regional or the guy in charge of the regional desk in front of a committee and be able to ask them, so what about this policy? Why did you think this was a good idea?
Yeah.
How much have you spent on this? Where's Kushner been? I mean, besides the trip that we know he took to Saudi Arabia that was only kind of, shall we say, sideways shuffled out of the core group of the Orange and Chiefs, you know, circle there. What other trips has he taken? Has he been, we can assume he's been to Israel, of course. He's been to the United Arab Emirates. Has he been to Egypt? Has he been to Turkey? Has he been to Iraq? I mean, hell, for all we know, he could have flown all the way to Iran. Well, probably not. They seem to want to start a war there, but you know what I'm saying.
But yeah, you don't know. Yeah. You don't
yeah.
Know. Is there, how does the budget of the White House handle?
I think they get a congressional appropriation, and I assume John Kelly has a stranglehold on it.
So if they're... I mean, it seems like you couldn't do much more without more money.
Like right, well, flights, the problem with Kushner is that he can ride his own private plane there, and we have no idea if he's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, it's not like this is like some bean counter or like other public official who's just, you know, doesn't have the means. Like, outside of the government's means, he's a guy at a keyboard in terms of foreign policy, but somebody like Kushner who has at least some money to, shall we say, implement his opinions.
Well, and there's 10,001 think tanks and writers and pundits and fucking TV hosts
that and podcasts.
People, yeah, there you go. That they can seek advice, policy advice on. It's wrong, but they could do it. And there's no reason not to privatize analysts too. Essentially, I mean, the State Department, just for example, would have people knowledgeable on subjects and looking into all of these and offering advice, as you said earlier.
They have a whole bureau of research.
But they could just go up and down DC and just...
Fine. They can pick and choose from whatever policies that, you know, suits their, I guess, financial and ideological interests.
Yeah, and so that none of that would be on the government's... Those people have independent funding.
Yep.
And so you don't even have to... And then there would be, because this is going through the White House, you wouldn't even have to... Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say you don't even have to say who advised you, but...
I mean, there are records, sort of, yeah. They're not being publicly released, and that doesn't exclude, like, you know, phones outside the chain of command. Like, John Kelly apparently has a pretty tight stranglehold on communications to the Oval Office, but I read a thing in the Times that he's using, people are calling Melania, and he's calling people to the residence after hours.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah so who's to say? I mean, obviously, there are probably things happening that are, shall we say, consequential, but for which there will never, ever be an official record, so.
Yeah.
Which I guess should lead us into our next topic. Because I feel like I'm about to go there.
All right, let's pause for a breather, collect our thoughts, and then come on back and we'll get pissed off.
The former dictator of Chile, as you must know, his forces perpetrated widespread human rights abuses, including torture and murder of over 3,000 people. Did Blackwater or any of its affiliated companies at that time use any Chilean contractors with ties to Pinochet?
Well, I can say Mr. Jackson did not admit to hiring some commandos. Yes, we did hire some Chileans. Any foreign national soldier that works for us now for the State Department have to have it. It's called a high public trust clearance. It's basically a security clearance for a third country national soldier where you take their name, it goes back through the U.S. Embassy in that country, and their name is run kind of like a national agency check here, which is what someone does for a security clearance.
Okay, I understand
that way
that
we
one
can
of
ensure
your,
that they have no criminal record, ma'am.
I understand that one of your business associates, Jose Miguel Pizarro, was indicted in Chile for his role in supplying commandos to serve Blackwater. Is that correct?
He was not an associate. He might have been a vendor to us.
Downstairs, in my little reading nook, I have a book on the side table called A Man Called Intrepid, which is a supposedly somewhat historically dubious book about William Stevenson, written by another guy named William Stevenson, which is weird. And it's about, no one knows, William Stevenson was one of the founders of modern British intelligence. He was the head of their Western Hemisphere operations during World War II. He helped the British sway American public opinion, along with FDR, to getting into World War II on behalf of the Allies. Now, in this book, they talk about something that really is not on the historical record because there aren't a lot of records of this. But supposedly before the war, Winston Churchill, who was not prime minister at that time, kind of privately got some people together to start gathering intelligence about the Nazis and Hitler's regime because they were arming themselves and breaking the Treaty of Versailles. And those reports were frightening to Winston Churchill, and he was sure that there was going to be a war with Germany, and he was right. So he had this little private intelligence thing going on that was not being run under, it was not really officially being done under the British government, per se. The Prime Minister at the time was not directly aware of all of this, because he was an appeaser, Neville Chamberlain, and Churchill thought he wouldn't allow any of this. Where I'm going with this is that there is a history of private intelligence work, and we kind of have that going on right now. Huh. And there's one other little connection here, which is William Stevenson, when he was working in New York, in Rockefeller Center, actually, which is pretty cool. He eventually started working closely with a guy named William Donovan, Wild Bill as they call it, who nowadays is revered as a legend in American intelligence. He's helped form the CIA. He has a statue, I believe, in front of their Langley office. And there's this guy nowadays, Eric Prince, who sees himself as the successor to William Donovan. He sees himself as that.
Wow.
And yeah. So there's a lot of wow about Eric Prince. And if you don't know out there, Eric Prince is most famous for having formed the company Blackwater, which is named after the swamps of North Carolina, where he set up this
facility.
Yeah, this training facility, which apparently originally was to just be a private place where CIA...
And law enforcement.
And law enforcement people could train, which is, you know, yeah, that's good. Well, yeah, it's innocuous at first glimpse, I would say.
I mean, to me, it's like anytime you mix law enforcement training and military training, and especially intelligence training, you're just going to run into problems.
Well, which they did. And so he did this in the late 90s. Eric Prince was a Navy SEAL for a short while until his father died and he had to go back and take care of the estate.
Right, he resigned his commission, didn't he?
Yeah, there was a he worked in the Balkans, or as a SEAL. He was in the Balkans, amongst a couple other places, I believe. And he was noted for being a good SEAL. He also, early on, before Blackwater, actually worked for Dana Rohrabacher, which, if you pay attention to the news lately, is a arguably a Russian asset in our U.S. Congress. At the very least, he's publicly friendly towards the Putin regime.
A very hard pro-Russia line.
Yeah. And Eric Prince set up this Blackwater, and in the late 90s, he supposedly was going to be training law enforcement to deal with like school shootings. This was in the wake of Columbine. But then something happened. Then 9/11 happened. And that really seemed to either change his focus or give him grounds for a mentality he always had, which is a sort of global religious war.
Yeah, he's always seemed, well, you don't, I guess maybe you can come to that later in life, but typically that's a policy that people have developed over the course of a long lifetime, and that guy seems to be of that type.
Yeah, I would, I believe I was reading last night that in 90, and a lot of what I've read, by the way, I want to give mention to Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept. He actually literally wrote the book on Blackwater. And he's done a number of reports on Eric Prince over the years.
Available at The Intercept.
There you go. He apparently, Eric Prince, even though he actually worked for, as a low-level person at a young age in the George H.W. Bush White House, he, in 92, he supported Pat Buchanan's campaign, which was a sort of hard Christian right wing, in the words of Scahill, insurgency campaign against H.W. Bush, who a number of people thought was too, you know, kind of establishment, too
centrist almost. For the
yeah.
time.
And so all of this background led Prince after 9/11 to focus his Blackwater organization on the Middle East, on counterterrorism, and frankly on just being good old fashioned anti-Muslim. So can you tell me, Charles, what's been going on with Prince lately?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. The reason why Eric Prince got so involved is that there were literally billions of reasons for him to get involved, because the military, the Department of Defense in particular, started handing out consultant contracts in the Department of State, too, which is what happened in Nusser Square. Those people were on a State Department protective detail when they shot up that square and killed, 17 civilians?
Yep. Why were there so many private contracts?
Because they didn't want to provide the military forces necessary for what they wanted to do, because that opens it up to, you know, public investigation and scrutiny. But if you have a private contractor just take the money, then whatever they do with the money and however they provide the services, I guess, up to history.
Yeah, I mean, another way to look at it, another way to say it too, is there was a reluctance by a lot of Americans for the war in Iraq. Not as much Afghanistan, but the war in Iraq. And there was a lot of argument about how many troops should we send. Should we have a bunch of troops on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to go around that issue by just taking money and giving it to other
former military people.
Yes.
Who'd just been there in a lot of the cases.
So you're saying that there was a selfish financial.
Absolutely.
Beyond
the ideological.
Crazy, yeah.
I mean, he has money because he was already from a rich family, the Prince family. But you know, he had billions more reasons to be involved other than just ideological, because say what you will, people typically don't fight based on how they pray.
Well, yeah, I mean, and he's in it. Hey, they were smart investments. I mean, he supposedly took a lot of money to form Blackwater, and within a decade, it was paying off and then some.
The Defense Department contracts are very lucrative.
I mean, it was hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars that his group was being paid.
All right, so what has he been up to lately? He's founded what is known as the Frontier Services Group out of Hong Kong, which is partly owned by the People's Republic. And it seems to be supporting their operations in places like Africa and the Middle East. Because as China expands economically, especially along the Silk Road and into Africa, they need the kind of services that Blackwater and, well, Eric Prince provided the American government and military. Because, you know, one thing that is typical of Chinese companies, especially building companies, is that they usually don't employ locals when they build a project. They will send hundreds, if not thousands, of the migrant workers that they'd get in China to, like, places like Ethiopia and such to build these roads and the train lines and the train stations, then bring them home. And so they need security and other support operations.
Why don't they provide their own security? Do they not have that?
Because that's an interesting political problem, where all of a sudden you would have Chinese people, probably Chinese military, on the ground in foreign countries, which is a very delicate problem domestically for the people, for the Communist Party.
Kind of the same thing as our issues.
Way more. Like,
yeah.
Part of their, you know, ideology is that they are strictly non-interventionist. Like, for instance, Premier Xi recently came out and said that they will not export their model as a matter of policy, which is way different than it was, obviously, in the 40s and 50s. So, yeah, he's providing those kind of services, and probably walking a very delicate line, if I had to bet.
Well, and because also he's, not just legally, but I guess politically. I mean, he's also, according to The Intercept, been a, quote, shadow advisor to the Trump first campaign, and then apparently now even the administration. His sister is the education secretary.
Betsy DeVos.
Yep, which at least shows, at least socially, he'd be sort of in those circles.
And then they're also close with the Mercers,
yep,
who provided a lot of Trump's funding.
Which would be close to Bannon and, yeah. And
right, because Bannon is also in there too.
And he has some radical ideas, this Eric Prince. It's hard to say whether this is just totally selfish, capitalist, make some money,
I mean, 9/11 was like the perfect blank check for the defense contract. Like, it basically created the defense contracting industry, and having somebody, a president with even less, hesitance to use the military.
Scruples.
Yeah, scruples. There you go. With even fewer scruples than George W. Bush, which, man, I never thought I'd say.
Oh my God, could you imagine? Could you imagine how back in 2003, 4, 5, 6, you know, like, if someone would have told us in 10 years or so?
This pretty terrible war criminal who, thankfully, is never really able to leave the country. So, yeah, is somehow going to be not the worst president in your lifetime.
Within a short period of time.
Right.
I don't think. I wouldn't have believed it.
It's like, what, are we going to get, like, a toxic tin pot dictator? Like, some kind of reality TV star who just, I guess, mutters his way into office and says all the high points? No, there's no way that could happen.
I mean, even discounting that person would be, you know, Trump and who obviously we all would have known at the time. But
I mean, there are other... I was thinking Sarah Palin. Anyways, we were talking about Eric Prince.
Well, yeah, so even beyond the kind of his profiteering, he's spoken before about how organizations like his bypass wasteful government, inefficient government bureaucracy,
and oversight.
But he doesn't say that part. They don't say that part because, that's best left.
I kind of want to say, if I could, I'd like to poke a few holes in that notion of business efficiency.
I really want to get into that because, to me, I don't understand, especially when you're talking about something that's a really top down thing like the military, why they would be so inefficient, but a private company being awarded hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of funds that have no accountability, why that is more efficient. I don't understand.
Well, for one, it's not. Yeah, like, even okay. if you yeah, just, yeah. like, a basic economic explanation. All right, so say the government spends $100 billion on providing a public good, which in this case is the military, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of that money goes to, like, paying the officers, the sergeants, and all the way down to the poor privates who don't really make that much. And then all of the equipment and facilities, space, land, fuel, bombs, ammunition, everything that they would need. All right, so take that same $100 billion from a private company, right, that's trying to do the same thing. But remember, they have to have profit, right? Because that's the overriding motive, especially because it's a private corporation, so they have to make a profit. So they're going to take at least 5, maybe 25% of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if they were going to try to provide the same amount of public good that the government is going to do, they'll only, for instance, be able to do it 95% as well. Or 75% as well, depending on how greedy they want to be.
Well, and they have other expenditures too, like lobbying for these contracts. They have to set up their own offices and everything, which would be they have to pay property taxes on and things like
that. Right, which they would further draw upon the money. Yeah, by the end of it, they'll probably be providing, say, 45% as much of the public good as analogous government bureaucracy would.
And that's assuming that 45% is spent efficiently.
There's a lot of assumptions in that argument I made, but admittedly, but just some broad strokes to.
I think that it's fair to say that there's almost I don't think there's a reasonable way you can look at it that they are inherently more efficient.
And then we can talk about the corruption aspect that you mentioned. So even if they did take like only that slight like 5% of profit and were somehow spending everything else efficiently, there's bound to be some measure of corruption. Either the government contract or the people who are providing them equipment will give them kickbacks so that they'll provide more money than the equipment is worth, or they'll buy a certain kind of equipment, which usually is not the best if the salesperson has to provide a kickback to sell it.
And that's because of, obviously, government, we have oversight of so many government institutions and agencies. And, of course, there are, you see these same problems there. But at the end of the day, there can be recourse to stop it or find it out. But there can't be in this case.
And especially with a private company, because you can say, again, we'll use this $100 billion military operation. Say that company wanted to spend, we'll say some ridiculously small number, like $200 million on providing, tactical communications, right?
Yeah.
And so there's no accountability, in the DOD, there's the procurement process. Somebody giving a kickback could be like, hey, just buy my system. And so they spend that $200 million and select a system that probably won't work. And so they'll end up having to spend that money again. And there won't be any recourse like there would be with the Defense Department or standards and procurement.
I think the important thing, because this gets to a big, broader kind of views of government, but it's not that government is always efficient. It's that the assumption that private companies are always efficient is
right.
baseless, and it's not even...
I mean, it's really business propaganda.
But the reason we are talking about Eric Prince, though, is that The Intercept came out with an article within the past day or two, and that was a follow-up of a BuzzFeed article about... Well, they both are about the general idea of the CIA under Mike Pompeo seems to be, there are reports, of course they are denying it, that they are seeking private intelligence work. That
right, because Pompeo doesn't trust the people underneath him.
Which will answer only to, according to the articles, the CIA director and the president.
And interestingly enough, according to that article, they've already started to try to prove their worth to Pompeo by providing him intelligence reports.
Yes, yes. It's so there's. I mean, what? Let's get into that for a second. There are these rogue spies and paramilitary groups out there that aren't even being paid to do this yet.
No, they're being paid, but I mean, the Amintore group is paying people to do this already.
Well, but I mean, the Amintore group isn't being paid yet. They're trying to obtain a contract.
Well, they're trying to obtain a contract to do kind of what they're already doing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the idea that there are private companies out there doing this.
Yeah, just think about that. That fucking horrible sociopath corporation that is now has apparently a half lethal, if not outright lethal, network of assassins and the ability to do dangerous things in faraway places that is now going to sell its services probably to the highest bidder. Because that's business efficiency.
Yeah. So, the BuzzFeed article laid out that there's this Amintore group, which is based in, of course, Whitefish, Montana, that, which, if you don't know, has some ties with some of the infrastructure rebuilding in Puerto Rico, and there was a...
The Secretary of the Interior is from there. Zinke.
Yep, and there Ryan was Zinke. Ryan Zinke. There was a controversial thing with that. But this Amintore group was first brought up as seeking this. Now, that article pointed out that, according to that journalist, there was no indication that Eric Prince had any direct ties, even though he has publicly said in the past that he thinks there should be more private contracting military and intelligence work.
Right, and he was known to be lobbying the Trump administration.
Yes. But now this article comes out and it tries to tie Eric Prince more into this. And it talks about frankly a friendship between Eric Prince and John R. McGuire, who is in this Amintore group, the vice president, and how it's, you know, they quote someone in the article as saying it's ridiculous to think that they're not in cahoots because they have such a close relationship and they are so, their motivations seem to be one and the same. And that they could be working together without Prince
even really knowing about it. Yeah.
Or even just having a financial stake directly in Amintore. Let's just quick give a little background on this John R. McGuire. He was a paramilitary officer in the CIA for a number of years.
Right, started out in Central America.
He was tied in with Iran-Contra, I believe. Look, you tell me this. So the article also pointed out how Oliver North is apparently kind of the public face, or not public, but is kind of their spokesperson a little bit for this. Mm-hmm. Why do people view Oliver North as a hero? What am I missing?
Because
he was fighting communists, or
yes, and they have to embrace him as a success because to do otherwise would point out the failures of their own ideology and what Reagan specifically was trying to do. And, you know, he got charged with 3 felonies, but beat him, so.
Well, he didn't. He was.
Well, he was in, right? he was found guilty, but then they were overturned on appeal, so he still beat him.
I thought he was pardoned.
Well, pardoned it. Well, at any rate, he got away with it.
Yeah. and turned it into a Fox News job. So apparently Maguire, the one other thing I wanted to bring up about Maguire is he apparently was the CIA section chief in Baghdad in 2003.
Oh, okay. So yeah.
And helped plan the invasion of Iraq.
Well, considering there was no planning, we obviously knew that's a lie.
Well, and why, and, like, why you wouldn't distance yourself from that fact?
Right, if you think that's a success, then maybe we should look at the next resume in the pile.
Yeah, it's like, hey, I helped run this terribly, this huge failure of a company. That
Well, it lost billions of dollars, thousands if not millions of lives. Well, certainly impacted if not lost.
I mean, especially because the CIA is so tied into getting us into that war and the lack of planning, exactly. You know, when we got into that, there were supposed to be weapons of mass destruction that we would find.
In their words.
He's the guy who said, oh yeah, no, we'll find them. We know where they are. And that wasn't true. And he wasn't able to get, I mean, he supposedly, I would imagine, helped sell the lie of Al-Qaeda's ties.
Oh, right, that little red herring.
That's a little bit of speculation, of course, but it's...
Advanced that argument, so somebody in the bureaucracy probably supported him.
I fail to see any positive of being associated with the plan, quote, the planning of the invasion of Iraq.
Right, because you're also the guy that told the administration, like, no, let's just ban the Iraqi army to start from scratch. We'll just, like, remove the government entirely. Just get rid of it.
And how fucking duplicitous is Trump, who's, like, says, oh, no, that was a terrible idea to go into Iraq. And then he's sitting here allowing this guy who helped plan that try and set up a private intelligence company that answers to him. I mean... Like, fuck you.
Oh my god, right?
Like, something there is not adding up.
To say the least.
Okay, so, to recap. Crazy, greedy, Christian ideologue. And we didn't even get into some of the other terrible stuff about Blackwater, by the way.
Glossing.
Who sees himself as some great intelligence leader, is, along with someone attached to the Iraq invasion and Iran-Contra, are trying to set up a private spy agency that answers only to our crazy reality TV star president and the head of the CIA, who apparently does not trust the members of his own agency, which might be smart on his behalf. Just selfishly speaking. Because,
yeah, but some of the things that they want to do are bringing back the worst excesses of, like, the Bush administration and all the way back to, like, COINTELPRO. Like, they're talking, like, one kind of dry run that they planned was to find people who were connected to the bombing in Lebanon, where they finally apparently found intelligence on them and were going to... render them and ask the administration who should we deliver these guys to. And then they also want to revive the Bush administration assassination program, which allegedly didn't actually kill anybody. But
the administration doesn't trust the CIA. Their reasons for not using the CIA are not at all what someone like you and I would not trust about the CIA. All the stuff we may not like about them are exactly what they like and want to have in their private agency.
Right, the parts that they don't trust, it's like, okay, these are reasonable people coming to reasonable, factual, reasonable conclusions based on facts. Yeah, I get that, that's respectable, but yeah, that's the part that they also don't like.
Yeah, they just don't, I mean... They just don't like that they are bowing down at the altar of orange.
Ultimate orange.
Altar of orange.
Oh, the altar of orange, I'm sorry.
The ultimate altar.
It's the most beautiful altar. We've got the best oranges. I'm the best orange.
I'm the best orange. Yeah. So, I think, to me, there's just an obvious conclusion with this segment, which is, this is fucking crazy. And
yeah, I don't really feel like we need to fill in too much about what to think about this. It's pretty terrible on its face.
For anyone listening, hopefully we don't have to tell you what to think, although I'm sure we've made that clear.
This is like one of those bad CD or advertisements in the middle of the night from like the 80s that advertise those terrible songs. If you remember the war in Iraq, Iran-Contra, with such hits as fucking Oliver North's fucking testimony in front of the Senate and pallets of cash disappearing off of airplanes.
and chemical weapons in Iraq, and look at the pictures, says Colin Powell. Yeah. It's all the worst. Yeah, it's all of the worst.
Yeah, I'm really trying to find a highlight, like something to be not necessarily worried about here, but I guess the thing is John Kelly might not allow this to happen, but I'm not sure how far removed that guy is from the president anymore. He seems pretty much complicit in the fact that he hasn't stamped his feet and walked out yet.
Well, you think Eric Prince is going to let a measly old chief of staff stop him from getting to
Trump? Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, that would prove how his value as an intelligence officer, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Although, if it's just involves calling Melania, I guess it doesn't take that much.
Yeah, that's a pretty easy call to make. But just think, he could be developing his own network of assets around the president right now, and nobody would know.
Okay, can I tell you one last bit about John McGuire?
Sure.
According to his LinkedIn page, he was a SWAT member in the Baltimore Police Department.
Of course he was. Of course he was.
That's how he apparently got recruited to join the CIA. And by the way, that was his job, at least, before joining the CIA. We can't get into the minds of whoever recruited him, of course. But
no, that fits a pattern I've heard from other people.
And I want a little bit too. It's not like he, with the CIA, was, you know, like a geopolitical thinker, analyst. He was a paramilitary officer.
Who was willing to obey instructions.
He focused on police special operations in high crime areas. Sniper operations, VIP protection operations, raids. I mean, he was a goon. He was the Punisher.
Yeah.
Call back here.
Well, not the Punisher. The Punisher was a principal Marine.
Okay. Well, I just mean he was...
He was the front line in the war on drugs.
Yeah, well, there was a line in the Punisher episode I just watched where Mike Rowe says to the Punisher, "You're a blunt instrument."
Yeah. John McGuire was a blunt instrument.
Yeah. I mean, he might be very intelligent and doesn't necessarily mean he wouldn't be good at anything else, but it's not like his background was.
Yeah, his background, I mean, if he was involved in Iran-Contra and was in Central America in the 80s, he probably wasn't distributing water pumps and roses.
He's only about hearts and minds in terms of ripping them out of a communist.
Knowing where to aim.
Yes. All right.
If you can, go for a headshot, but not always aim center mast. Yasser Arafat's houses with tanks and so he's literally living in like a 10x10 concrete square that they hadn't bulldozed around them.
So I just want to do a couple follow-ups on some of our past topics. A few things from the news this week that struck me as interesting. See your thoughts on these as I go through them. There was a report out of I saw in the Jerusalem Post that Israel is selling arms to Myanmar. which was said by someone in Myanmar, and then they were told to retract their statement.
Israel does not sell arms to Myanmar.
Yeah. Apparently they're not a major supplier, but they do seem to be supplying them to Myanmar.
I mean, they could sell specialized equipment, like certainly intercept equipment, help track rebel leaders trying to use their sat phones or even cell phones and tactical radios.
Yeah.
Isn't that what the FBI outsourced to an Israeli company, breaking an iPhone?
You'd know better than I would.
Yeah, that whole thing some months ago, and the FBI ended up outsourcing. I mean, that's what they're probably going for, specialized military equipment, the kind of classified stuff that you don't necessarily wouldn't publish those procurement records openly anyway.
Yeah. Something else that struck me was a New York Times story, still staying on Myanmar, of not only the genocide, you know, that we've discussed in the past of the Rohingya, but it's even deeper. Apparently, they are kind of erasing the culture of them as if they never existed.
Well, there is a reason they think 1984 was modeled upon Burma rather than Soviet Russia, because George Orwell was a British commissar in Burma.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. awesome. I did not know that. That's super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, cool in like a terrible way.
So it's not especially surprising that, you know, the kind of tactics that you see spelled out in 1984 are being used in Burma. In the modern day, of course, they're going to write out their enemies.
Something else that stuck out, follow-up of our CFPB talk, a couple updates on that. Cordray, the recently resigned head of the CFPB, is reportedly about to, or just did, I think he's expected to announce his candidacy for Ohio governor.
Mm-hmm. A natural promotion after his time as attorney general there.
Yep, exactly. And an office where he could affect change. Another one to do with the CFPB. Sort of. This is stretching it a bit, but I like this one, which is, that we talked about Trump making that comment about Elizabeth Warren being Pocahontas to those Navajo Code Talker veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, supposedly, the Trump administration is going to shrink the size of Bear Ears National Monument. And
by 90%.
Yep. And so now there are Navajo that are suing the Trump administration for that.
I loved their legal reasoning, though, from what I've heard of it, is that although the Antiquities Act allows the president to designate areas as, like, you know, national parks and other protected areas, there's no provision in the law that says he can remove that listing.
Interesting. Well, I thought that's what the Obama administration thought when they did this.
I mean, that seems natural.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, how is it a monument? I mean,
we've never taken away a national park, to my knowledge.
Yeah, no, I mean, they've maybe changed some rules for how they're managed, but no, I thought that stuff was as permanent as it gets in this country. Because I remember when they made the national monument, there's a big water national monument around Hawaii.
Thank you, Bush.
And when they did it, they said, you know, so that this will be existing for, you know,
in perpetuity.
Yeah. And they wouldn't have, you know, they didn't say, you know, until there's a
the next president decides, hey, I like to fish here, or something equally absurd.
Exactly. It just
It's like, we want to rob the grubs. We want to rob the graves of Navajos, or ancient Navajo people.
Another little bit, we've talked in the first episode about Jeff Sessions and Roy Moore. The little update on the Roy Moore thing is that the RNC is now funding him.
So we've moved completely back to what, like nothing happened.
Yep, the past 2 weeks, all of the people accusing him.
I saw that there was another yearbook that a lady presented with his obvious signature in it. Well, at least his Roy. So I guess the facts are absurd and nothing matters.
I bet he has a bunch of yearbooks sitting in his house, and, like, in his basement.
No, these are the yearbooks that he's signed of women. Ugh.
No, I'm saying, but I bet.
Oh, you think he also bought the yearbooks from the high schools?
Yeah.
Did you read the strange article in The Guardian about his time in the Australian outback?
I knew he went there. He was like a cowboy, right?
Yeah, so apparently after he was thwarted in his political aspirations by the local elite, for, you know, because who knows why they would oppose the good honorable Roy Moore from achieving higher political office, but apparently he went out to the outback to a super Christian, like, cattle farm out in the middle of nowhere, and just worked out there for half a year. Apparently the people said he was a troubled man who was struggling with something. It was the only way that they would characterize it. And he was 37 at the time, so...
Oh, and this would have been just after all these allegations then, right?
Yeah, because, you know, he was 32 when he apparently molested a 14-year-old. And so if he had been doing that for a few years, and then the locals were like, you need to stop. We're not making you judge. You can GTFO. Then he went and found God in the outback, I guess. So I don't know. It's an interesting story.
I didn't connect that dot myself earlier, because I knew that timeline, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Man, oh man. And none of these allegations have been recent.
No, they're not. They notionally stopped, apparently, after he went out to the outback and, I don't know, castrated himself or...
Yeah, who the hell? Does he have children? You know,
I don't know. Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's the best news I've heard today.
He has four children, two sons and two daughters.
He does have children.
Micah, Caleb, Ori, and Heather.
What was that third one?
Ori.
Ori?
Mm-hmm.
How do you spell that? O-R-I?
O-R-Y.
Ori? What the hell is that short? Well, it has to be short for something.
You'd
think it'd be a biblical name. Original Sin?
She's short for original. It's Ori, short for original.
Okay. Couple other follow-ups. Supposedly Yemen's ex-president, Ali Abdullah Saleh broke
with the Houthi militants, and then they apparently killed him in an attack, and now there's an ongoing fight for Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. The UN a few days ago was trying to evacuate their personnel, so hopefully everybody who's able to get away from the line of fire is able. Has gotten out of the way, because apparently hundreds of people have been killed there in the last few days, and thousands more injured, and shall we say intense sectarian violence as these two rival factions now vie for control. Saleh's faction basically ruled Sana'a, because he was a longtime political leader of Yemen, and so the capital was basically his, and now the Houthis are trying to call it theirs.
So, do you see, I mean, is it just going to, does his death lead to any shift, or is it just lead to more, even more chaos?
Well, Saleh was reaching out to the KSA-led coalition, or the Saudi-led coalition, so it looks like the Houthis are just being forced even further back into a corner that either makes them desperate, or, I mean... I don't understand the mentality of making somebody more desperate and then hoping that they'll negotiate. That my mind, is antithetical to any reasonable or serious negotiation.
Well, it does sort of seem like it. I don't think it's going to lead to someone to negotiate. Maybe more likely to negotiate, but if they are going to negotiate, you're trying to get a strong advantage over them. You're trying to get, if they do negotiate, trying to get them to
just go along with whatever you want.
Exactly.
But that doesn't last.
Well,
because they don't really want to go along with it. So.
Especially when you're talking about complex things like ethnic groups and societies and states. And, just to me, it reminds me a little bit of like almost like a criminal investigation, trying to get almost like the Mueller Flynn, you know, trying to get someone to flip and be a state's witness.
Mm.
You know, you put the pressure on them so that they'll talk. Then, but
they're more willing to, they're more likely to give you what they want. But I don't see how the Saudis aren't. Well, it makes me wonder how interested they are in coexistence if they're not just willing to achieve some kind of, you know, amicable stability.
Yes, exactly. I don't think that logic holds when you're not talking about individuals and you're talking about bigger groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd think so, but these are still individuals making these decisions, so. Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Okay. I was going to say Zimbabwe. President Mnangagwa's announced his first cabinet. He ran into some troubles at first because he appointed too many people who weren't elected officials. He had too many generals and just political tools that he elected into the cabinet. And so he got rid of a education minister who was widely despised and somebody else in his cabinet. But it's full of generals and other hardline political allies of his and Mugabe's. So don't expect the line to change anytime soon. There's not going to be any, this isn't some kind of late Arab Spring movement or color revolution.
Well, and, you know, surprise, surprise, military puts man in power. Man tries to put, you know,
military in power.
Pay
right?
back the military. I mean, it's totally to be a
Like it's some of the really terrible people, like the guy in charge of the 5th Brigade that, you know, carried out some of those early ethnic atrocities in Zimbabwe, is now a cabinet official.
From the time of their revolution?
Just after the revolution, after they achieved independence and they were, shall we say, cementing their control.
Yeah.
So, he also, in another sign of what is likely to happen, by virtue of his cabinet, but other moves suggest that he's not going to try to open up to Western governments, the United Nations, any more than Mugabe was. They're going to go for a hardline xenophobic nationalism.
What is their angle when it comes to that? Are they trying to control thought or keep out foreign?
Well, they've seen Zimbabwe's they want. If they're currently in control of all of the resources and all the levers of power, and they know Zimbabwe is a sustainable economy in and of itself because it used to export so much food and resources out to the rest of the world. But, and so they're going to try to restore that, but also keep or allow it to enrich and empower them and who they want to see empowered. Which is so self-defeating, and the nepotism and other corrupt forms of corruption involved make it an enterprise or an endeavor that's destined to fail from the start, but that's what they're going to do, from my estimation. So what else are you going to follow up on?
The only other thing was, and it's kind of it's another one that's a slight bit of a stretch, but in the Observer, there was an interview with the defense minister of Poland, and it's just a little bit of a take on the the EU militarization, and I think it's a pretty big topic to get into exactly what he was talking about, but it's just sort of because we talked previously about the EU starting to pool resources for military, and then this one is him talking about having a strong national defense, independent sovereign defense. And I just think it speaks to...
Right, but he would definitely be willing to contribute to, you know, the EU if they, if their security goals were in alignment.
For sure. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that guy is, his, shall we say, informal militias that he was talking about, like, oh, that, you know, civilian militia, that's terrible. That guy's kind of a hyper-conservative ideologue, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a defense minister, and so he's been able to form these dangerous organizations, like a civilian group.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand, like, in the article specifically, he was mentioning using a civilian militia against Shpetnaz troops, Russian strategic sabotage troops that would, you know, parachute way behind enemy lines and take out key strategic installations. But, you know, Sunshine is the best tool against them, so a civilian militia is, I guess, kind of a good idea, but I don't necessarily trust somebody like him who has virulent anti-communist ideas and has held them for his entire life to be, to use this as a purely security organization. This isn't like a neighborhood watch. This is going to be something political.
Yeah. What I found interesting as well is that he made a big point of that plane that had their president and a number of their government officials,
the prime minister, crashed in Russia.
Smolensk.
Mm-hmm. Smolensk.
I guess there's a report that they have been putting together that will be coming out about that.
Oh, okay,
I don't know what that's going to have. That could cause...
I mean, that might be the moving the capital to Jerusalem in terms of EU-Russian relations.
Yeah, but what I was going to say, though, is that he makes a point that it's not so much whether or not I, some dude in America, agrees, but I do empathize with, which is, I believe the interviewer asked him, about this militarization that they're going through, and he's like, the guy was very clear, this is about Smolensk. They feel threatened. It's the classic Polish, you know, again, knowing history. I get it. I mean, I get it. Doesn't mean it's the right thing, but I get it.
It's, at least somewhat rational, apparently, if you think Smolensk was, oh god, a Russian attack, that'd be terrible.
And especially, too, as, you know, okay, so if they think that the Russians shot down a large portion of their government, Russia's right on their border. Russia has invaded them in the past. And if you, at the same time that all that's happening, Russia starts, you know, shortly thereafter, you know, starts invading another country on their border.
Yeah, we can say that they invaded Crimea, at least.
Yep, and you have an American government that
is apparently willing to go along with it.
Yeah, was not really taking a hard stance on that, and you've relied your whole history, not your whole history, but past few decades, on relying on allies to protect you.
Yeah, I guess we did set up an intervention brigade in Poland in the last few years, but with Donald Trump in office, if he is colluding or is compromised by the Russians, this is a great opportunity for the Russians to do something about the European problem.
Which, you know damn well, that, you know, there's a lot of reports of European intelligence agencies who, you know, are making claims about Trump, who claim to know, you know, whatever about him and his relationship with Russia and all of that. I would be shocked if one of them was not Polish intelligence.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that, you know, I don't know exactly what they think. Doesn't mean that what they think is correct. But I bet they think something. I bet they have thoughts on Trump.
I mean, you gotta be worried if they're talking about the U.S. president and your fucking dangerous enemy next door in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Like, even a friendly relationship between the two doesn't bode well for Poland.
something. Oh, here, let me just read that question. So the interviewer asked, is this what you believe to be a, quote, lesson learned from 1939, that you never know if your allies will honor their agreements? And the guy says, I want to be frank, this is the lesson of Smolensk. So it's not, you know, necessarily about World War II, not necessarily just about Ukraine, although those are all factors, but he's making it clear that that had an effect on their country, or at least they're using it as an excuse for it. I think I empathize with that. I mean, hey, how much, you know, in our country.
Can you imagine what would have happened if President Barack Obama had gotten crashed in Mexico? Even if it was just like a pure aviation accident, he would have invaded.
Well, as big as 9/11 was, if that plane would have hit the White House and was taking out the president.
Oh, man.
As big as it was. Bloody wars,
that's a terrible note to end it on.
Hey, the tradition of this show. Pressing, depressing news.
We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Full of peace. Today's it's sunny. Today's it rains. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!